Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible for your health and well-being. I hope you're having a great day today. This is always such a wonderful opportunity for me to share great in-depth conversations with people who are really inspiring. And as always, this is going to be another show that will really open your eyes to many important issues, particularly regarding our health, particularly regarding how we breathe. I know that many of us are awakened in the middle of the night with a partner that's snoring, and we have to kind of hit them in the ribs, get them to turn over so we can get a good night's sleep. Also, we have lots of people who discover they wake up in the morning, their mouth is really dry, maybe sore, or maybe they find that they just find it extremely difficult during the day to be breathing through their nose. So they tend to be breathing through their mouth. Well, as it turns out, mouth breathing, however we do it, either through the problem of sleep apnea or through clogged sinuses that contribute to having to use the backup system, our mouth, to breathe, is really a problem that can have serious consequences. It can have serious consequences to how our faces are structured, and it can have serious consequences to overall health and well-being. So today we're going to be talking about many of the hidden causes and consequences that can contribute to insomnia, cognitive decline, even hormonal imbalances from how we breathe and what air passage we choose to breathe from. So to help us be enlightened on this subject is my guest today, Dr. Michael Gelb. He is the clinical professor at NYU College of Dentistry, and he has a practice which focuses on pain, headache, TMJ, and sleep apnea disorders in New York City. He is the co-founder of the American Academy of Physiologic Medicine and Dentistry, an interdisciplinary group dedicated to early identification of airway issues. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Michael Gelb to the show today. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Cheryl. Nice to be here with everybody.
Well, it's great to have you today. You have enlightened me on this issue of mouth breathing and all the many consequences that has been actually quite a revelation to me. So I know that what you are sharing today on the show will also open people's eyes to an issue that has far greater implications than we ever realized. So, Michael, let's talk about airway issues. Let's talk about what your work is and the impact of breathing through the mouth.
Okay, it's a good subject, and it starts at birth in probably 20 to 25% of all kids. So this is something that I never realized, and until the paper came out from Stanford from a Dr. Guimenon, we never realized that kids are born, and this is also having to do with epigenetic factors, which I know you talk about. Kids are being born today with high, narrow palates, which we see a lot in premature kids, but we see it in other children as a result of the diet of their parents, environmental factors, and it's becoming much more common than it was, let's say, 30 years ago. So that's a big issue. So these kids are basically born as mouth breathers, and the question is, if they can't breathe through their nose, how are they really going to successfully breastfeed? And it leads just to a whole host of problems that go from there.
So let's focus a little bit more on what you say is the epigenetic factors that cause our infants these days, which I would imagine is not the way it's always been, but what's happening in present time due to the impact of diet of parents and grandparents. Can you elaborate a little bit more about
that?
Sure.
So, you know, if you look at the work of someone like Daniel Lieberman, who talks about the development of the face and how we've developed from an evolutionary standpoint, even from a just regular evolutionary developmental standpoint, our faces have been flattened. Our faces have been pushed in compared to Neanderthal, you know, from the primates, from the apes going to Neanderthal. In our development, when we became upright, more bipedal, our faces have gotten pushed in. In the last 200 years, post-industrial revolution, women going back to work, less breastfeeding, softer diet particularly, teeth have gotten more crooked and things have gotten worse. In the last 30 years, with the effect of pesticides, DDT, heavy metals, we've seen even a progression epigenetically, and that is in terms of the phenotype, or what we're seeing as the arches, the development of the upper jaw becoming even more narrow, and we've seen this in rats, we see it in pigs, and it can be reversed somewhat by a healthy diet, by chewing foods that require more mastication, more chewing, not a soft, sloppy, goopy type of diet. So, you know, it's not all bad. Some of the stuff can be reversed, but that's what I talk about when I say epigenetically. It's really in the last 30 years, particularly as diet has changed, as the environmental has changed, more pesticides, more heavy metals, that this is seen in the change of the face and the change in the development of our ability to breathe.
Now, Western A. Price did a lot of research in the 1930s looking at cultures as they were transitioning from their traditional foods to denatured, westernized foods. And he actually caught a moment in time when the transition was occurring and how the Western diet was actually manifesting as these changes in our structural makeup.
Exactly.
And you know, so you would see the people that ate a traditional diet, healthy, you know, healthy grains, healthy fruits, vegetables, no processed foods, and their face was wide. They had perfectly aligned teeth, beautiful smiles, and, you know, a very different look from siblings in some cases as twins, who would be eating a Western white bread, white sugar diet, and their faces got very narrow, their teeth were crowded, you know, they were crooked in all sorts of ways, but their whole facial structure was narrow, and which was causing their teeth to get crooked, and because there was no room in their mouth. And it was a startling revelation to see how the body physically and structurally altered from a change in diet.
Yes, amazing. And, you know, furthermore, primitive man had no cavities. And then when they went, even at these, during the time of Weston Price's work, these kids started getting rampant decay after they got a subject to an industrialized diet. So there was very obvious changes, you're right. And Weston Price was, he really documented this probably better than anybody else. So that's a great example of what I was talking about.
And you also have another example that I think is really helpful for people to get an idea of what's happening. Talk about the bulldog.
You know, yeah, I love talking about the bulldog. And, you know, this came when I read this article in the New York Times about maybe a year and a half ago, and we're talking about Uga the bulldog, the Georgia bulldog, and the actual change in Georgia and Georgia's mascot, the bulldog, from 1956 up until the present time. And if you look at the bulldog, you go from a dog that has a pretty good size, a decent sized snout, a thin neck, the tongue is not overly big, the teeth are straight, and the dog lives to, let's say, 8, 9, 10 years old. Well, you go to the modern bulldog, and the neck is huge, the nostrils, the snout is pushed in, the dog can't breathe, the teeth are crooked, the tongue is enlarged. And these dogs die anywhere between 2 years of age and 4 years of age. They die from cardiovascular disease. They die from cancer. And basically, they're being bred to extinction. I mean, the dog cannot live. The dog can't breathe. The dog has no airway. And I really say that we are becoming the bulldog. And there's been all kinds of outrage from animal rights activists saying that the breed should be outlawed because the dogs can't survive. And people actually think they're cute.
Oh, gosh. So these dogs have become deformed. And as a result of the deformities, anyone who has pugs and bulldogs, we know that their breathing, their nose, their nostrils have been so compressed and, you know, suppressed and, that they always have breathing issues. But they're just an example of a, in a very profound way of the consequences when we have an impaired ability to breathe.
Yes, exactly. I found out a couple more things since I've talked to you last, and that is that, you know, as the neck has gotten bigger, as the airway's gotten smaller, you know, the tongue has gotten larger, and the human, we are the only ones where our epiglottis, this is something that is used when we breastfeed, and so we don't, when we eat, the liquid doesn't go down into our lungs. The epiglottis descends in the infant between 6 months and 1 year of age. We have this hyoid bone that's not strutted. If you look at the angle of our airway, because our head is on top of our shoulders, the airway takes basically a 90-degree turn. So between us and the bulldogs, we are really, those are the two examples of someone who has really airway insufficiency. And I think it's just a great example because as we get heavier, our tongue gets bigger, the tissues inside our mouth get bigger, but and yet the box, the mouth itself, is actually getting smaller.
So when you say heavier, it's like when people become overweight and obese.
They gain weight in their tongue. They gain weight in their throat. So when men gain weight, we gain weight in our waist, belly fat, and we gain weight in our necks. Women tend to gain weight in other places, their backsides, their thighs, but not so much like men, not so much with belly fat, not so much in the neck. So for a man, if I tell a man, if you lose 10 pounds, he's probably going to lose 2 pounds in his neck, and his airway is going to actually get larger as he loses weight. So that's motivation for people to take off weight because it's going to open up, it'll open up the airway. Conversely, as we put on weight, and this is why the rates of apnea very closely follow the rates of obesity. So as our obesity rates are approaching 30-40%, apnea is approaching 20-25% in our population.
So define sleep apnea so we all know what you are referring to.
So apnea is the absence of breath for 10 seconds or longer. And apnea goes back. It pretty much was described by Dickens, Joe the Fat Boy in Dickens' stories. And apnea is accompanied by something that's less severe called hypopnea, which is really a partial obstruction, which is also accompanied by a drop in oxygen. So we either have a full obstruction or a partial obstruction, and we basically add up the number of events per hour, and we get some sort of a rating or a scale of just how bad your apnea is. Is it mild? Is it moderate? Or, you know, is it severe?
And why is sleep apnea, which is, of course, part of what contributes to people having to be put on CPAP machines, right?
Correct.
Great.
So why is it dangerous? As we stop breathing, there's a couple of things. One is that we get deprived of oxygen. So we have this thing called hypoxia or low oxygen levels, and that occurs all through the night. And the effect on that of the body is the release of inflammatory byproducts, tumor necrosis factor, interleukin, these inflammatory tissues. So the body, actually the whole body becomes inflamed. The other thing that happens is the body feels threatened. So how would you feel if you were being choked throughout the night? There was someone in bed with you, they were putting their hands around your neck, and they were literally suffocating you or choking you. Your body would feel threatened. So the sympathetic nervous system releases cortisol. You become sympathetically driven, and your blood pressure goes up during the day, and you have anxiety and you have panic, and it's not a very pleasant situation. And the heart, you know, our hearts don't do very well with this for obvious reasons, but one, the decrease in oxygen, and two, the sympathetic nervous system effects. And, you know, we could talk oxidative stress and things like endothelial dysfunction, but the other thing that happens is that our brain gets disrupted many, many hundreds of times during the night. So we get these arousals or we get these awakenings of the brain, and people wake up and they don't feel refreshed. They no longer get a good night's sleep. And I think that's the complaint that I hear more than anything else. Doctor, Dr. Gelb, I'd like to get a good night's sleep. I want to feel refreshed when I wake up. I don't feel good anymore. I don't have my energy anymore. And so the sleep fragmentation is probably as important as much deleterious health effects and as the fact that we're not breathing, as the fact that we're not getting oxygen. So when people say, you know, sleep deprivation is the equivalent of, you know, being drunk when you miss a night's sleep, or, you know, there's tons of research on the effect of sleep deprivation, but we're saying even if you do get your 7 to 8 hours or you get your 6 or 7 hours, what's the quality of your sleep? And I think that's as important as, because if you're getting 8 to 9 to 10 hours of sleep, but you're not breathing and your brain's waking up during that time, it's not serving you well.
So what I hear you saying, all the consequences of not being able to have proper deep breathing is that you are creating more inflammation, you're creating more oxidative stress, you are starving your brain, you're starving your body of oxygen levels, all of which are factors that contribute to cancer, you know, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. I mean, we're really looking at root cause issues here that are driving chronic illnesses.
And it's treatable, and it's reversible, and it's preventable. Probably even easier, although changing your diet is profound. But what we're saying is it's the missing link. You just can't talk about diet without talking about sleep, exercise, and a good mental outlook on things. But you got to talk about sleep in the same breath that you talk about diet.
So if we are, for a variety of reasons, such as you mentioned, putting on weight, can constrict the airways. Then if you're inflamed, eating toxic foods, which causes the tissues in the sinus area to get inflamed and blocked, we'll get a bit to that in a minute,
mm-hmm.
You're actually setting yourself up for compromised health and aggravating the very conditions that brought it about as well.
Exactly. If I say to you, or you talk to me about weight gain, how do I want to, you know, people say just get 7 to 8 hours of sleep, make sure that you're breathing well, you will have the option of losing weight just by increasing your hours of sleep. I mean, it could be that simple. I mean, that's a good start, but sleep has to be part of your program, of your formula, of the recipe, when you're talking about not just losing weight, but when you're talking about good health.
So before we get too much into this conversation, I want to go back to something you started off with saying, because I think it's really important, another piece of what's happening to the development of our bodies and our culture, and that's with your comment about 20 or more percent of children are born with the inability to breathe through their mouth. I want us to just talk a little bit about that, stay on that topic, because that has many ramifications as well.
Yeah, it does. And that's really one of the things that I'm passionate about is we start looking at kids, and Karen Bonnick did a landmark study where she looked at kids that were 6 months old, 18 months, and 30 months, and found a high proportion of mouth breathing, apnea, and snoring in these infants. And then she looked at their behavior when they got to be 4 and 7. Even if they stopped snoring, even if they stopped being a mouth breather, there were sometimes permanent irreversible effects in their attentiveness, their behavior, their ability to get along with peers, their anxiety, their depression, all stemming from brain development issues, breathing issues related to prefrontal cortex development issues that manifest in amazingly increasing 20 to 60% increase at age 4 and 40 to 100% increase at age 7 as a result of these sleep-disordered breathing phenomena. So to me, brain development, we're talking about our kids and we're talking about behavior, we're talking about kids being isolated, aggressive behavior, school shootings. I think we're all talking about the same thing. which is ADHD, which goes back to these epigenetic factors, and it's relating, and it's just, it's a combination of things. But I think that's what you were getting at, right, with these young children, and it's starting early. And so that's why we're going back to the children and our ability to eventually to intervene and to prevent some of this abnormal behavior and to prevent these irreversible changes to areas like the prefrontal cortex.
So if babies are born with high palates, their passageways are blocked or constricted.
Correct.
And then they are not breastfed. Because talk about the role of breastfeeding in creating structural in our mouth.
Right. So the very act, the physical act of the infant breastfeeding and the movement of the nipple up against the palate actually expands the palate. It starts the process of expanding the upper jaw. It prevents this narrowness. It actually is the most potent orthodontic tool that we have available. And that is, you know, ideally 6 months of breastfeeding. And that is the start of being able to train the tongue and train the muscles and the development of not only a good-looking face, but the development of good immunity. So the immune system gets a real head start by 6 months of breastfeeding, then followed by a solid diet, followed by solid foods. So we're not really talking about baby foods. We're not talking about formula so much. We're talking about 6 months, ideally 2 months. We know statistically confers an advantage over and to prevent sleep disordered breathing, but ideally the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends 6 months of breastfeeding, and the coaching from lactation consultants, La Leche League, doulas, it's so important that, you know, these women get helped with being able to breastfeed. And you know, it has to work. We have to sometimes work with the infant that's low tone, and we work with the mother, and, you know, it's a combination. It's something that I never thought that I would learn about, but it's very important to the future for our kids to be able to breastfeed. It will produce healthier kids with better-looking faces.
So let's talk about bottle feeding and using pacifiers and how they can alter the structure.
Right, so we work a lot with myofunctional therapists, and we've learned that pacifiers, habits like thumb sucking, they do deleterious things to the tongue. So you don't develop the normal type of action of the nipple going against the upper palate. It actually trains the tongue to go back, and it leads even to high narrow palates. So we're against pacifiers. Thumb sucking, I had a person in today, and you could see the imprint. Basically, the patient is 35 years old. You can basically see the imprint, or the shape of their palate is the size of their thumb. And so the thumb going up in that palate, exactly what you don't want in terms of something molding the shape of your palate, because a high narrow palate is associated with sleep disordered breathing, disrupted sleep, and all the inflammatory consequences that we were talking about. So habits are something that we have to intervene with, and then we work with occupational therapists, because a lot of the children are born what we call with hypotonia or low tone. They're hypotonic, and they don't always have the suck, swallow, and breathe reflex. So they might be able to suck on a thumb, but they can't swallow the breast milk. So occupational therapists are very helpful to reestablish the tone for a lot of these kids. And these are the kids that are slack-jawed. You can kind of see these low-tone kids, and these reflexes can be developed by working with occupational therapists and then myofunctional therapists. And so this is really an interdisciplinary type of field where we need various type of practitioners to get in there at various stages of development and to help the child along and to get the tone, you know, back into those muscles. So that's just another part of the puzzle, or piece of the puzzle.
And I just want to reiterate something you said earlier in regards to children, because I think it's so incredibly important, and that's the role of proper breathing for cognitive functioning in children. And there's a correlation with kids who've been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and mouth breathing. Can you just elaborate on that? Because that's just so profound.
You mean the effect of the effect of nasal breathing? So yeah, so you know, everyone talks about meditation. Everyone talks. We know that breathing is good. When a child is a mouth breather, that's usually a sign that they cannot breathe through their nose. So it sets up a pattern. Mouth breathing unto itself is a form of airway resistance. It's a form of an inability or a blockage of the nose, which could be from allergy. It could be that they have a high narrow palate and their form is not correct. And that sets up from the beginning disturbed sleep, interrupted sleep, which has an effect on brain development. This is just from breathing alone. And then mouth breathing can go on, and we can talk about facial development from there. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. I just really want to...
Because most parents think it's cute. I mean, actually, you see these kids that are mouth breathers, and then you see them again 8 or 10 years later, and or 3 or 4 years later, either they're bouncing off the walls, they're hyperactive, or they're falling asleep in school. And it starts off very innocuously as just a kid who's mouth breathing. And the parent doesn't know that it's not cute. The parent doesn't know because no one ever told them this information. They don't know that mouth breathing is really the first sign of a sleep problem or a potential sleep disorder. So I think that needs to be reiterated, because like American Indian children, the parents train the kids to keep their lips together and to breathe through the nose.
This is such a big picture. You know, whenever you talk about this, and I've heard you lecture about this, and we've had conversations before, because I find it so fascinating. Who would have thought that the choice of airways that we use, or for many people, the ones they have to use because they can't breathe properly numerous reasons, can have such long-term effects, including changing the structure of your child's face as they developed. And
right.
I think maybe you need to just elaborate on that for a few minutes, because it's better to have photos, because you've shown photos of
yes.
lectures I've attended. It's just staggering.
You see someone like Napoleon Dynamite. When you see a mouth breather, you're seeing someone who has developed a longer face, the mouth is opening up, and they have to breathe through the oral airway, through the mouth, because they can't breathe through the nose. What happens in the development of these kids, they develop these long faces. You see a bump on the nose because everything is dragging down and back, and the bone is there. The cartilage gets dragged back, and these kids have allergic shiners under their eyes.
Which are like dark
circles. Dark circles. The lower jaw goes back. The lower jaw grows down and back. And so they don't have a very flattering profile. The upper jaw is also back. And so instead of having this all-American or this horizontal, this well-formed, well-proportioned, nice rest posture, relaxed muscle tone, you see a very strained, we call it an adenoid facies. And Dr. Harville did the work first with monkeys, where he plugged up their noses and he actually could change the development of the faces of these monkeys. And we see it in children. We see it in children all the time. And it's a profound effect.
I think most people have no idea that how your child is breathing or how you breathe as a child can determine or has determined your face, your facial structure, how you actually look.
Yeah, and, you know, something that I don't want to leave out is that, you know, one thing we talked about in the beginning is how our teeth are getting more and more crooked. And, you know, if you look at the kids today and you have these 18-year-olds coming in. They're all getting their wisdom teeth taken out. And, you know, 400 years ago, if you look at Smithsonian Institute or you look at New York Museum of Natural History, we used to have room for all 32 teeth. We used to have these well-developed skulls, and, you know, Daniel Lieberman shows this and other people. We used to have very well, broad, well-developed arches, and we could fit all 32 teeth in. So now you go to the orthodontist, you're 8 years old, you're 9 years old, the orthodontist says, oh my God, you've got so much crowding in your mouth, we've got to take out four teeth. We've got to take out teeth, we've got to take out permanent teeth. And we still have about 20 to 25 or 30% of the orthodontic community still believing, and they're proponents of, oh God, you have such crowding. They don't say we have to expand because they don't believe that we can expand. They say to us, well, we have to make the airway, and it's not really, they don't believe they're making the airway smaller, but they say we have to take out permanent teeth because little Johnny or Susie won't have room for all the teeth.
Or little Cheryl.
Or little Cheryl, anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of those kids that you're describing, having those teeth, you know, taken out, four perfectly good bicuspids, and mouth was too crowded, and, you know, tend to have the narrow face, although I am not a mouth breather, thank goodness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a good place to take a pause. We're about to have a break. And when we come back, what I'd like you to do, Michael, is talk about some of the solutions you've found and work with in your practice.
Okay.
So hang in there, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, Dr. Michael Gelb, and we will be right back. Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome back to What Women Must Know. We are having a fascinating conversation today with Dr. Michael Gelb, who is a clinical professor at NYU College of Dentistry. He has a practice in New York City, which is focusing on pain, headaches, TMJ, and sleep disorders. He is the co-founder of the American Academy of Physiologic Medicine and Dentistry, and is here talking to us today about the consequences of breathing through our mouth and how our diet and our cultural propensity to be very toxic has contributed to physiological changes, structural changes within our body, and is altering our health destiny. I guess that's a good way to say it, huh, Michael?
That is. Very good. Very well done.
Can we talk about hormonal imbalances? Have you seen any hormonal imbalances from people who are mouth breathers and have obstructed breathing problems?
You know, we know that things like leptin, ghrelin, we know the body's got to produce more cortisol, you're running on fumes, but I don't know that I would really, I do know that after perimenopause, that's when women tend to get more sleep apnea, you know, that and pregnancy, but I know that so perimenopause and menopause plays into women developing sleep disordered breathing. That's really when you see it peaking in women.
That's so interesting. I wonder if it has to do with the fact that in perimenopause, women tend to get more estrogen dominant. So their hormones change. They tend to have higher levels of estrogen. Estrogen is pro-inflammatory. It causes weight gain. So I'm wondering if that may have something to do with the changes that are happening within a woman's body. And
I think it can. You know, obviously the estrogen receptors in the TM joints, we see primarily women, 80% women having the pain complaints, and that is from puberty up to perimenopause and a little bit beyond that. So, you know, it's something I have to pay a little bit more attention to.
Right. So, okay. So what do we do? What are some of the solutions you have found? I know you use this awareness in your practice. It's a primary focus of your practice, and I know you're writing a book about this issue, which is wonderful. We await that book.
Okay.
So what have you discovered to really help people?
Right. So it starts off with noticing and taking taking a look at the kids and again, seeing if they're mouth breathers versus nose breathers. And if they are mouth breathers, looking at things like allergies, food allergies, dairy, wheat, things like that. For the kids that are born tongue-tied, we're having everyone look at frenums from when the children are born. That is the attachments to the tongue, because many kids, and in Brazil they just passed a law to make this mandatory that we look for these frenum type of attachments, to look for things like tongue tie and degrees of tongue tie, because unless a tongue can move, you can't really breastfeed successfully, and that unto itself, being tongue tied, leads to developmental and changes in form. We then work with people like ENTs at age 3.5 or 4, or whenever it's appropriate, and we're starting to revert back to getting tonsils and adenoids at least shaved. Doing a tonsillotomy, we leave some lymphatic tissue today in certain circumstances, and then we work, intervene early, and I'm talking about sometimes 3.5, sometimes 4, because with orthodontics, to do palatal expansion. The reason we're intervening early is because now that we realize the role of sleep and breathing and brain development, if there's anything we can do to widen those narrow palates, why not do it earlier so we can get the kids mainstream by the time they're 5 years old, by the time they're in kindergarten? So we're doing that, and then we're combining that with myofunctional therapy. So the kids are starting to do exercises at an early age so that hopefully by 4 or 5, we're done, and we've established a large enough airway that the child may not become a apneic, may not have snoring. So our goal is not only to prevent ADHD, and Dr. Steve Sheldon from Lurie Hospital, part of Northwestern in Chicago, Dr. Sheldon tells us that up to 2/3 of all of ADHD is really coming from a sleep disorder. That gives us a lot of hope that if we can manage the sleep disorder and manage it early, the kids won't be on Strattera, Concerta, Ritalin, Adderall, because we can really get at what's really causing this different type of behavior. So that's one of the best ways that can we intervene as a team, by working with the ENT, the orthodontist or pediatric dentist, and pediatric dentists are starting to pick up on this. And then we work with Joy Moeller and Mark Moeller and the people involved in myofunctional therapy.
Which is what?
Myofunctional therapy is the training of the tongue. It's habit elimination, and it's establishing the tone and the proper rest oral posture. So it's teaching a child how to keep their lips together and how to put their tongue in the proper position so we get palatal development. So it's teaching them how to hold themselves, how to develop their muscles with certain exercises, which is so necessary. So that's like the third thing. That's the missing piece, because we know that about 51% of the kids that have tonsils and adenoids, they still have sleep apnea. You add in the orthodontic, the palatal expansion, and you do really well, but if you want to make it last, the myofunctional therapy is needed in many cases to change the pattern of the muscles and ingrain it and make it permanent. So that's what we're advocating for the kids, in terms of a prevention and addressing that. But we can intervene at any age. So what we're doing, we call it airway-centric orthodontics. We'd like to do the orthodontics around the airway. We know that if you build the face around an open airway, you're going to build a healthy face. You are going to have the best looking kids possible, because you're going to develop the face horizontally instead of having a long, what we call retronathic face. You're going to have a well developed with more horizontal growth, because we're all about developing the airway. Instead of having the face flat and our snouts pushed in, and by the way, that's why we have so much nasal issues and sinus problems as humans, because our sinuses are tiny compared to the sinuses of our forebears, okay? And if you look at those skulls, if you look at the skulls at Smithsonian and you look at the skulls at Natural History, they've got huge sinuses. So our sinuses have basically been shrunken our noses have been shrunken. That's why we can't really smell very well compared to other mammals. So there's a lot we can do preventively. Orthodontics is part of it. And then we get into things like oral appliances. So there's certain types of orthodontic appliances, and then we have what I do, which is using appliances for adults, where we prevent the jaw, the tongue, from going back. So the reason that a dentist would be involved in this is that 90% of the obstruction in the airway is behind the tongue and behind the soft palate. So it's behind the upper jaw and the lower jaw. And because this is primarily a gravity disease, you notice that you snore and have these issues when you lay on your back, we prevent the jaw from dropping back at night. So that's one, you know, easy way to do it. There's something called CPAP, which is continuous positive airway pressure, or BiPAP, which is basically forcing air down the airway to open it. And then we work with our surgeons, our ENT friends, to do things like making sure that we can breathe through our nose, fixing deviated septums, shrinking turbinates, shrinking palatal sizes, taking out tonsils and adenoids and things like that.
So, well, what are some of the things that actually contribute to blocking the sinuses that swell them up? Because there are also factors from our diet and the choices we're making that are contributing to not only the obesity issue, which,
sure,
you said, which is really profound for people to understand, the more overweight you are, the more you're impairing your breathing, but there are also things that are generating the swelling of,
sure,
our sinus membranes.
Right, so dairy, sometimes mucus producing. There's a lot of diets today that are focusing on inflammation. And there are a lot of foods that we shouldn't be eating because they create a swelling or inflammation in our sinuses. There's a lot of drainage always going on in the sinuses. A lot of times diet can correct that. That's exactly right. And a lot of people think that a lot of people have chronic sinus issues. I see it in my patients that are clenching their teeth and they have chronic sinus pain. Really nothing wrong with the sinuses. So I think you need to make I think we can't rely only on the surgeons. I think these functional shifts and this functional medicine, the change in diet and realizing what's really not so good for us, by going on an elimination diet, for example, and that's something that, you know, Cheryl, you're much more better versed than I am, but we're very aware that food sensitivities and allergies are a big part of what's happening to the sinus.
And
no
what
doubt.
What do you recommend to people who can't come see you? They don't, you know, either they can't afford it, they don't have dentists who understand what they're doing, or for whatever variety of reasons, and need to be able to sleep better at night. You know, address the sleep apnea issue, help with how their tongues are falling back. What are some of the things that these people can do? Because a CPAP machine is not a fun thing to be on.
Right. So things like BreatheRight strips, Dr. Howard Hinden and I are inventing an over-the-counter sleep device that is going to be adjustable, and it'll be a very high-quality device. It'll cost about maybe $69. It's not going to be very expensive. And people are going to be able to avail themselves of the kind of technology that we're doing in our offices in New York, and they'll be able to do that over the counter. Neti pots, you know, sinus washes, anything that opens the nose will help. Sleeping on the side is a big help. Getting a pillow wedge so that your head doesn't go all the way back, so that you're not leaning all the way back at night can be a big help.
So just by changing posture and
sure,
how you sleep at night can improve the quality of your sleep, which will reduce the risk factor for all these chronic illnesses.
Exactly. So you don't want to lay all the way back. You know, if you sleep on your side, that is a big help. We don't advocate sleeping on the stomach because that's not good for the neck. Sleeping in a cool room, humidifiers, comfortable sheets, dark. You know, things like eliminating light from the room and all the sleep hygiene things, not looking at a computer screen for a half an hour before you go to bed is a big help. Taking cell phones out of the room so you don't hear the pings at night, that can be very helpful. So there's a lot of things that are fragmenting our sleep that we can eliminate, and we can wake up feeling much more refreshed.
You know, I've had people who had issues with their sinuses. They were blocked. They couldn't breathe out of their nose, and they would use the neti pot,
right,
which is an old Ayurvedic treatment to help clear the sinuses of debris and use as a preventative technique, actually, to prevent colds and flus, which, of course, are, you know, bacteria and viruses that go up through the sinus passages. And even sinuses are great breeding places for fungus and mold. So by doing a neti pot religiously every day, they actually reduce the swelling of the sinuses, cleared out the bacteria and molds, and that was just using some salt water, and had great results, didn't need surgery.
Right, great idea. I mean, why not? Why wouldn't everyone try that?
And what about taping the mouth? I know that sounds kind of cruel.
Yeah, taping the mouth is a great technique. As long as you can breathe through the nose, you know, there are people that are teaching a technique like Buteyko, which evidently is effective. I think it might need more, you know, some scientific verification, but people can be taught to breathe through their nose. So taping the mouth is not a bad idea. And I have certain respiratory therapists and restorative breathing coaches that are doing that, because we can learn how to breathe through our noses.
As long as they're not blocked, as long as the sinus is
exactly swollen. As long as you have an open, but you can slow your breathing down, and you can train someone to breathe through the nose.
Right. Interesting. So what are some of those other techniques that or devices that are out there to open up the...
There are things that go in your nostrils, like Breeze, B-R-E-Z.
Yeah.
There are other things that actually open up your nose. So if you put your hand on either side of your nostrils and you pull and it opens up your nose, there are devices that fit in and that actually, like a Breathe Right strip, but they're inside the nose that open up the nose. I use an oral appliance called the Oasis appliance that was invented by Mark Abramson, and that appliance opens up the nose at the same time that it opens up the oral airway, oral pharyngeal airway. So that's a great appliance, because most of my patients cannot breathe through their nose, and they may not want to use strips. So that appliance does both. So anything that you can use, I mean, tape is good on the mouth, but anything you can use to open up that nasal airway, and if you're opening up the nasal airway and you're opening up the oral airway, you're, you know, 75% of the way there.
Right. And I guess it just is important to reiterate to everyone listening how important it is to breathe through your nose and not to breathe through your mouth, because if you breathe through your mouth, you're also more vulnerable to getting infections and colds,
sure,
and flus, right?
And larger tonsils and adenoids. And, you know, people that breathe through their mouth have forward head posture, and so neck pain is going to be increased. Headache is increased. Those occipital headaches, the frontal headaches, those people. So you are able to have better posture if you breathe through your nose than if you're a mouth breather.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good health benefits that come through slow, steady nasal breathing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so fascinating, because it's something we do every day, and yet so few of us really think about the long-term consequences, starting from birth all the way through, you know, the rest of our lives. Before we kind of wrap things up here, Michael, what about special pacifiers for babies? We talked about how pacifiers and the nipples on bottles actually contribute to a higher palate that can,
yes,
you know, lead to poor breathing. And as you were saying, ADHD issues. I mean, this is a huge thing for so many people listening. Their kids who are having these hyperactive reactions or sleeping at school may be experiencing the consequences of not being able to breathe properly.
So, yeah. You know, that's a good point. There are Nook, you know, the Nook nipple is better. There are some pacifiers that have more anatomical type nipples that that are definitely better than the old-fashioned type of pacifiers. And, you know, there are pediatric sleep specialists today. You know, the public should know that there are pediatric sleep specialists out there, people like Steve Sheldon, Kanjeev Kathari in New York at NYU, Stephanie Zandia. We've got a whole bunch at NYU. You've got Judy Owens down in D.C., Carol Marcus, Ron Chervin. There's tons of really good pediatric sleep specialists around the country. And the important thing sometimes is to make a diagnosis. And I think people get very frustrated because they'll go to their pediatrician, the pediatrician says, you know what, just watch it. Just take, you know, keep an eye on it. Meanwhile, the kid has ADHD or, you know, let's medicate it. And there are other, you've got to keep looking until you find someone that really, I think, understands this and gets it. And very often that could be a pediatric ear, nose, and throat specialist. It could be, but it's very hard to find these people. It can be hard. So that's why we formed the AAPMD. It's a nonprofit. We try to link the public. The public can be a member for free, and we're trying to link the public up with practitioners that understand this airway-centric type philosophy and are willing to intervene and willing to see the kids early on.
Well, I think just having an awareness for people listening today that mouth breathing is very detrimental to our health, and we need to do whatever it takes to open up the nasal passages so we can breathe properly and help support our health, help our kids create more attractive faces. I don't know who what do you call it? He's what's the one
Napoleon Dynamite.
I have no idea who you're talking about, but he must
everyone have a study. There was a movie about him. Yeah, he's a well-known guy.
Well, I guess if people want to understand what you're talking about, go look up Napoleon Dynamite and see what he looks like. Is there anything else you want to complete with, Michael, before we get to the end of the show today?
I just want to make, you know, parents aware, and we'll be coming out with more information and to give people hope that a lot of these issues are preventable, and the parents have to be really the advocates, because that's the only way we're going to be able to change the paradigm. And really, that's where we're looking to change the paradigm of how healthcare is being practiced. So you've got to ask your practitioner for it and not just accept what your, you know, ENT pediatrician or your orthodontist is telling you, because there's other ideas out there.
So just one little point before we wrap things up. You were talking about the traditional way of doing orthodontics was to take out the teeth so you can have more room in the mouth. So what you're saying is that parents are wanting to help their children, look for orthodontists who are willing to open up and expand the palate.
Correct.
Rather than having to pull teeth.
Right, because they'll tell the parents that there's not enough room, and it sounds convincing, but I would go for a second
opinion. And is there an organization that they can go to get that information?
Yeah, if they go to the American Academy of Physiological Medicine and Dentistry, AAPMD.org, or they go to a group like facefocused.com or orthotropics.com. There's several groups out there that are not into pulling teeth and are into expansion and early intervention.
Okay. And, Michael, do you have a website?
Yeah, the Gelb Center. GelbCenter.com is also a good resource.
Okay, that's wonderful. Well, thank you for your pioneering work in addressing an issue that is so important but not well understood.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure having you today, Dr. Michael Gelb.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Thank you. And to all of you listening, thank you. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now. No.